From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public service professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Mark Carbonaggi, Dan Johnson, Marty Garrity, and Nick Calm. Our program tonight coming to you by home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Nice to have you with us. Happy New Year. There are no calls tonight because we are recorded. But again, if you'd like to send me an email comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. You want to send me a tweet, it's @Dumo. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video every single week on this broadcast, beyondthebeltway.com. If you miss it on a Sunday night, we're here all the time at beyondthebeltway.com. We've got a whole year to review tonight, and it has been quite a year. And I want to begin with our guests with a specific question, because each one, I think, will have a different perspective on this. As you look back at all the events of this past year, either things that happened because you're a member of that party or things that happened on the other side that bring glee to your body. Mike Carbonaggi, we're going to start with you. You're a Cook County elected Democrat, Board of Review. My question to you is, what was the most significant national or international political story of the year in your view?
Probably how quickly and how effectively folks mobilized. So, you know, for a lot of Democrats, the election of Donald Trump was a shock. And I think back to 2000 when Al Gore and George Bush had a heated race and ultimately it was decided by the Supreme Court. Democrats spent about 2 years until the midterms wandering. We didn't know who we were and what we were. In this situation, the day after the inauguration, a million women marched in Washington, and since then it's been one organizing effort after the other, and it showed up at the ballot box.
One of our Republicans is Nick Calm. Nick, what is your answer to the same question? Biggest story of the year to you?
Well, I would say, Bruce, it's the gift of Harry Reid. I think what Harry Reid did in terms of changing how the Senate approves judicial appointments has been an incredible gift to Republicans, and we've seen it with a record number of appointments that the Trump administration has made.
Dan Johnson, one of our other Democrats, progressive Democrat. Nice to have you with us.
Great to be here.
Happy New Year.
And congratulations. This is your last day on an amazing run building the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
That's it. A couple of hours to go.
That's right. We're still in it.
Then my signature on the check means nothing.
I'll take that $100,000 check, please. I'll deposit it tomorrow. This was the year of Donald Trump. This was politically.
Made you happy then, right?
I like to call it, it's our walking dystopia nightmare that we have Comrade Trump and the authoritarians have taken over our republic. But it was clearly his political year. He reshaped federal politics. And the one signature defining accomplishment, besides, as Nick said, appointing a lot of ridiculously unqualified judges for a lifetime, is cutting corporate tax rates. And they did it.
Marty Garrity, your other card-carrying conservative Republican, biggest story of the year?
I'd say the biggest story of the year is the tax bill that was passed last week, which essentially defines the election of 2018. Either it's going to be a disastrous tax course, and the Democrats are going to take everything in 2018 and probably impeach Donald Trump, or the Republican version of what is likely to happen will come true, and we may not even remember the name of the Democratic Party as of January 2019.
Mike, do you agree with that? Any piece of that you agree with?
I agree that one of the parties is no longer business, but I would argue that it used to be the Grand Old Party. Bought and sold to a guy who everything he touches in the Republican Party goes bad. Walks into Virginia, they lose. Walks into, I didn't believe it, Alabama, they lose. Democrats are outperforming.
When you say they, who do you mean by they?
Every candidate that he comes in, that Donald Trump, President Trump, comes in to support, campaign for, support on Facebook,
on a political front, is the Roy Moore loss, is it good or bad for Republicans?
It is bad. for Republicans.
We've got Republicans over here. They're shaking their heads the other way.
Because the margin in the Senate where they need to get things done. Again, to Dan's point, they're not getting anything done, and they barely limped out of 2017 with any kind of agenda. As they wander into 18, you look at the agenda in 18 and go, what's it going to be? They've got smaller margins and a more liberated Senate to not support the White House. Okay, so Nick, as a Democrat, I feel really great. We're going to get some
stuff
done.
I mean, there's no question that if Roy Moore had somehow squeaked out or eked out a victory in Alabama, the Democrats would have hung him around the neck of every Republican running for every seat in the country. So I think it was a momentary bit of rationality there by the Republicans in Alabama in terms of not coming out and not supporting him. So I don't think at all it was a gift. I think it's actually they're very fortunate for the Republicans that Moore lost.
And Johnson, what's your take on this?
Look,
I mean, we have Senator-elect Doug Jones.
Yes.
He's going to be taking the oath of office in a few days.
Which is great.
His mentor was Howell Heflin. Yeah. One of the most conservative Democrats in the Senate. So are you optimistic that this guy is he going to go and vote the way of Chuck Schumer?
No.
Or is he looking at reelection and he may be a lot more moderate or conservative Democrat than you personally like?
He's going to vote. In ways that I personally, as a Bernie Sanders delegate, don't like at all. And I'm going to be delighted that he's serving in the Senate. I think it's important that the South have Democratic representation. And I want to credit, to Nick's point, people like Republican Senator Richard Shelby, who a few days before that election said, I will not vote for Roy Moore, and I'm going to write somebody in.
That was the turning point, I think.
I think there are two things that are worth noting. One is, undeniably, half the Republican electorate are people that are happy to support folks like Roy Moore or authoritarians that are happy to be in bed with Russia. Half the Republican electorate doesn't like that and never liked the rise of Trump and is sort of enduring him because they'll, you know, advance the agenda. But let's not pretend that really problematic part of the Republican electorate that is for Moore and for the authoritarians hasn't gone away.
Marty Gerdy.
When you think about it, it wouldn't make much difference in the U.S. Senate this year, next year, if there are 52 Republicans or 51 Republicans, because you've got Collins and Murkowski, and in fact, Corker will still be there, and there's no telling what those guys are going to do. So the notion of
McCain may not be there.
But the difference between 52 and 51 is nothing. In fact, what it really does, if I'm Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski, I'm delighted because now they need me alone.
Here's another issue. Because of the sexual harassment issue, which started in Hollywood, then ended up in Washington, as well as a lot of other stops in between, the media headquarters of many networks. What do the Republicans have to do, and do they have an opportunity, Nick, because your reputation restoration, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. Do they have an opportunity to restore the reputation of the party in the wake of Roy Moore and compete with the Democrats for appealing to women, but because they seem to have responded in a much more demonstrative way to the sexual harassment issue than have the Republicans?
Well, I think based on the fact that you've had serial harassment from both sides of the aisle, and I think the fact that that's been exposed to be a problem with both parties, I don't know that the Democrats or Republicans are really having an advantage to press there. What's interesting is whether the Democratic position about the war on women is going to endure or not, because they've had enough problems on their side.
We've got a pause. We will return. Thanks for joining us on New Year's Eve 2017. Yeah, we're on.
Oh, sorry about that.
Gotta stay awake.
Wow, easy.
I know it's New Year's Eve.
Easy on the bubbly, Garrity. Take it easy on the champagne.
What is in your eggnog that you're giving us all, Bruce?
That's very strong.
I would say that Americans have adopted a rather reasonable approach to this, and that is there's nothing you can really do about it individually. As a society or as a police force, maybe something can be done, but I don't really think that I can worry about whether I should go downtown on a particular Tuesday night, because if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And we become sort of fatalistic, but I think
and suburbanites usually are worried about coming down on a Tuesday night anyway.
Well, Tuesday nights are a bad night. You know.
Mike, what about it?
5 years ago, a mentally deranged person walked into a school and killed 21st graders in Newtown. And I remember thinking, if this doesn't serve as a wake-up call to have a responsible, bipartisan conversation about gun control, nothing will, and nothing has happened. So I'm not sure what it's going to take. I mean, a madman went to an outdoor country music festival, and in a planned, methodical assassination attempt, you called it terrorism, I think that's the right word, killed dozens of people and injured hundreds more. I'm not sure.
Legally. Everything you did legally.
Legally.
Well, that begs the question.
And I'm not sure what it's going to take for that conversation to move into action.
Nick.
I have a different take on it, and probably an unorthodox one for a Republican to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think if it is somebody like the shooter in Las Vegas or the shooter in Newtown, Connecticut, or there was one a number of years ago in Nebraska that my firm was involved with dealing with.
There was one in Texas this year, too.
In Texas as well. I think if it's somebody who is not obviously a Muslim, I think Americans tend to look at it in a more dismissive, fatalistic way, as Marty was saying. I think there's still a very heightened level of sensitivity because of 9/11 and related issues. I think if it is somebody who is doing it in the name of Islam or as a Muslim name, I think the level of sensitivity that Americans have is still very high around that, and it leads to a desire for action where, sadly, and I agree, it's sad that when it's somebody who is not with that as their persuasion, there tends to be a more dismissive attitude.
I just want to add one thing in. You know, you think about, and I'm glad you mentioned that, kind of just giving the fact pattern kind of drives a lot of this conversation. I mentioned Newtown as I had a first grader at the time that happened. And I just remember my wife and I, when the kids went to bed, just being shaken and going, what does this mean? Then you think about all the other ones. Okay, maybe members of Congress will want to move this conversation toward responsible gun control if one of their own is shot. Gabby Giffords is shot. Okay, well, maybe if it's not a Democrat, if it's a Republican. This time a Republican got shot at the congressional softball game. Mm-hmm. So the fact patterns just drive them more and more, and you're like, okay, you know, I'm not sure what it's going to take, but we have to have a thoughtful, responsible conversation.
The shooting of Steve Scalise at a Republican softball, based on the shooter there and his background, we had some connections to Illinois. I mean, he had a political agenda, and the question is, because of the climate we have in the country, because of this, whether it's the resistance movement or the reaction to Barack Obama, we can go back how many years you want, but because of this hatred that is based, in many cases, based on partisanship, that bothered me, mm-hmm. because you had a Democrat out to look to kill Republicans. There wasn't an outrage about it, but that's a fact of life in that particular case.
I think I put him in the same mentally deranged category as the one who massacred those people in Vegas and the people that shot up, you know, my elementary school of Hubbard Woods and the people that shot up in Newton. I think there are lots of mentally deranged people. And I think to Nick's point, I appreciate your candor because it is true. Way too many Americans treat a brown person that shoots up innocent people differently than a white person. And that's wrong, not only morally, it's just wrong in that it directs us to try to stop this from happening down the wrong path. Like saying this ridiculous Muslim ban, as if that's going to protect any of us, instead of saying mentally deranged people ought not have weapons of mass destruction.
Well, if you knew that all of the Muslims that have done this were mentally deranged, that your point might be good. But these are not people who are mentally deranged. These are people who know what they're doing, who know why they're doing it, and whose point is political and most literally terroristic. They are terrorists in the most literal sense of the word. And that's different from the wacko who shot up Steve Scalise or who shot up Newtown. That's a very, very different thing.
But
if you can prevent people like that from getting in, or at least investigate them, vet them carefully before they get here.
But of course, how many of the 9/11 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, right? And of course, Saudi Arabia is not in the ban.
But
the idea
irrelevancy, Dan.
What do you mean irrelevant?
You know,
let's be honest. The Muslim ban is an outrageously ineffective and stupid response to try to preventing terror when you look at the facts of where terrorist attacks in our country have come from.
They've come from all over the place except for that.
Well, no, but I just...
But that was before the issue.
Is it safe to say, Dan, that if you're looking at countries that do not have any infrastructure to properly vet the people, their officials to vet the people coming from their country, and they have no paper trail. Is it so outrageous to say that maybe people from that country either should be held up for a while, not let into the country, or certainly they deserve a much stronger vetting? Because there's nobody, you know, in their home cities or home countries.
Yeah, but who are
that
we?
Are doing
but
job.
Like, who are we applying this to? Syrian refugees. These are orphans, largely women. The people that have had the worst 2017 imaginable.
Right.
And we're applying it to them. And to me, and one more point.
But everything
let me just say one point.
The defense of this is everything is about women and children. Now, you know, in that group, because we've had intelligence experts, if you believe them, who say that within that group, there could also be young men who have a desire to be jihadis.
Yeah, there could be. Nothing is riskless.
If you look at the photos of the people.
What I found to be appalling is when Republicans made banning Syrian refugees, when embracing refugees is about as American as apple pie inscribed in the base of the Statue of Liberty, making that a partisan political issue, which they did to some degree successful, was, I think, helping to set the table for all the abominations of the Trump administration and the folks like Roy Moore that are riding on this dumb wave.
It's the fear issue that I talked about before and the different kind of reaction that a violent incident perpetrated by a Muslim or somebody with a Muslim-sounding name provokes in people, and that's clearly a response to that. I think you can take a different point of view as to whether that's the right solution to it or more vetting or both or whatever it is, but I think that's clearly where that comes from.
I want to switch gears and go to something else, which really is a dominating story of the year, and that is the investigation into allegations that the Russians somehow colluded with the Trump administration. It's really dominant. It's been the big story of the year. Obviously, there was the firing of James Comey, the hiring of Bob Mueller, the recent indiscretions of the FBI agents looking into the investigation. So my question to – I'm going to ask everybody. If we turn back the clock a year, Donald Trump had not yet been elected or he had been elected, but he was the president in waiting. When you look at everything that's transpired since the resistance began the day after the president was inaugurated on January 20th, Mike, are you confident that the Democrats, that the resistance movement, that you have made a really solid case that Donald Trump somehow was manipulated by the Russians? Do you believe that based on everything that we know now in the investigation?
We have an ongoing step back. Before I had my current job, I was a federal prosecutor. Everybody I know who worked with Mueller said that this registered Republican, Marine veteran, Silver Star, was a man of credibility, as McCain and Lindsey Graham and a number of other Republicans have said it.
Newt Gingrich.
And Newt Gingrich has said that. And also, it was kind of that gold star on your resume. If your career somehow brought you into a matter with him, because it meant that you were a person of credibility. So to ask, is it the resistance, has the resistance brought those facts out? I think what you're seeing with Bob Mueller is a quiet, thoughtful procedure where he's collecting written evidence, bank records and what have you, phone records, email records, bringing in witnesses then to corroborate, answer questions about those written records, and then bringing in indictments and, when possible, getting people to cooperate to move the investigation forward. We're at the beginning of it. We're really at the beginning.
Okay. As a former federal prosecutor.
Sure.
And again, let me say that the description of Robert Mueller as Mr. Integrity from the get-go is something that everybody still talks about. The indiscretions of the FBI agents, albeit they were ultimately fired by Bob Mueller. He didn't release that information real quickly, though. But on that staff, there were allegations from the get-go that staff, that investigative staff, was filled with Democrats, some of whom just wrote checks to the Democratic Party. And again, perhaps they can be show some degree of integrity and bias. But when you look at Peter Skorich, and his lady friend, the FBI lawyer. I mean, can you, as a former federal prosecutor, can you say, wait a minute, this guy really screwed up? Not Mueller screwed up, because he should have known the level of hatred this guy had. And frankly, Skorich screwed up because he should have volunteered to Bob Mueller when he was being investigated. Hey, listen, I don't think I can do an objective job here because I hate the guy so much he's an idiot.
Everything I've seen has shown that Bob Mueller did exactly what you should have done. When he became aware of the scorched person, he immediately didn't ask him for to resign. He fired him. And then everything we're seeing right now says that these investigators, like anybody, have the right to their own opinions.
We're going to come back to that because the Republicans are shaking their heads the other way. Okay. We'll hear from them and more from Dan Johnson when we roll on New Year's Eve 2017. Wherever you are, hopefully you're not drinking and driving right now. Choose what you want to do and then do it well. New Year's Eve 2017. Boy, it's been a great year. I know everybody's going out to celebrate after the show tonight. But, Nick, you and Marty Garrity were shaking your head horizontally, viciously, when Mike Carbonaggi was making a point about the FBI agent. One bad apple in the investigative team should not throw out all of the evidence that they have uncovered so far.
Well, I'm amazed when I hear Democrats say, you know, FBI agents, they're like everybody else. They're entitled to their own political opinions. Everything is fine. Of course they're entitled to their political opinions. But if those political opinions become so extreme that it calls the behavior of people who are charged with investigating and exculpating the Democrats' nominee for President Hillary Clinton or leading the investigation into President Trump, we have a major problem. I mean, if we can sit there and we can investigate, and I think many people would agree, I think most people would agree that the Russians did try to influence the election. I don't know many Republicans and certainly no Democrats that say, oh, no, the Russians didn't try to influence our election. They did. The question is whether the Trump people were involved. Again, Flynn, Mueller was able to get a guilty plea out of Flynn. We'll see what happens with Manafort. But the idea that somehow because Mueller fired this FBI agent, somehow everything's okay. We don't need to investigate what he did or didn't change in terms of the language exonerating Hillary Clinton. It's ridiculous. I think if we're going to investigate, let's investigate everything.
A quick question. I want to come back to Marty, but I want to ask you, Dan, just on that particular point.
Yeah.
Would you acknowledge that the revelations about Peter Skorich and his texts to his lady friend, the lawyer, would you acknowledge that that creates at least an appearance of impropriety?
I think Nick put it well that, first of all, what happened to respecting law enforcement? And
what does that have to do with it?
Well, I'll tell you what it has to do with it. Here's what's really troubling.
Are there no crooked cops?
Of course there are.
Are there crooked FBI agents?
Of course there are. And are there crooked presidents that
built a real estate empire likely funded by Russian billionaire oligarchs
who refuses to disclose where his money came from?
You're off the reservation. Back to my question.
Are there presidents
back
like that that while in office?
Could be. back to my question.
Yeah.
Because I think on this program, you generally can be pretty objective.
Yeah, I try to
be. I'm going back to just this point.
Yeah.
Does it raise an appearance of impropriety that you have this person, Peter Skorich,
yes,
who is not only in on investigating the president, who he hates, despises,
yeah,
and also that person was in on the interview with Hillary Clinton and suggested to James Comey that he change the language, and the changing of that language resulted in Hillary Clinton not being indicted. Does that stink? Even a little bit? Is it even a little bit stinky?
I think Nick is right. I think if there's a bad apple, remove them, punish them, and if it means you got to take another look at an investigation from last year, I'm fine with that. But let's just recall, let's not pretend the FBI is some Democratic operative organization. When let's recall the last week before the election, it was that FBI, including those crazy Trump FBI folks in the New York office, that pushed this letter saying it's an open investigation into the biggest non-story ever, the emails, which swung the election in a significant way. Let's just put it in the broader
context.
Let's
recall before that, I mean, the reason that the FBI had to do, or the Attorney General had, the FBI had to do that, is that he had preempted the prosecutorial procedure earlier by saying there's no reason to indict anybody here. There's nothing to see here. Remember too that there is, as of right now, this Mueller, this wonderful fellow Mueller, has come up with nothing that indicates that there has been any collusion. He may come up with something,
sure.
But as of right now, there is no allegation that any collusion occurred between Trump and the Russians. The collusion that is there is the Steele dossier, which was funded and promoted by the Democrats.
And all turned out to be accurate so far.
Yeah, right.
And it's all been accurate.
And it's all about the Democrats working with the Russians to get something done to help win the election. And it's about the Russians trying to help the Democrats win the election.
Wow.
Mike, no amount of bias can create evidence of a crime that wasn't committed. And what we've seen here is a mountain of evidence that we've seen in the early stages of an investigation from Mueller of communication, correspondence, cooperation, maybe collusion, that has resulted in less than a year in two indictments and two pleas with now cooperating witnesses. So Mueller is at the beginning, maybe midpoint. We don't know about his investigation. And as it moves forward, we can expect Trump to fire up his base and certain Republican members of Congress to demand special investigations and inquiries. What's best for the country and democracy is if a person with unimpugned integrity in Robert Mueller that Democrats and Republicans have entrusted to continue this investigation without distraction.
A large portion of the country no longer trusts him. They no longer buy.
Don't say large part of the country no longer. The president wants you. He grabs it and says it.
I'll withdraw the word larger. There is, I think growing is an appropriate word. There's a growing number of people who are not necessarily, you know, they're not politically astute in that they're not reading the political columns every single day. They will look at this. They will read the texts of this guy with his girlfriend, the FBI lawyer. They'll read those and they'll say, hey, how can this guy be objective? If evidence is coming before his desk that makes Donald Trump, is there anything that's exculpatory to Donald Trump that this guy's going to accept? Or is he going to reject
everything?
To me, it doesn't pass the fairness test.
No, but Bruce,
I'm glad he's fired. He should be fired.
But Bruce, I don't know. I haven't run into many Republicans who now question Mueller's integrity. Okay?
The judgment is whether or not he did the proper job of vetting every single member of the team he hired.
But I think the bigger issue is that this investigation now of the Trump administration has become irretrievably tainted because of these fired FBI agents who were at the center of the investigation.
I don't buy that.
I think it's going to be very difficult for the conclusion of that investigation to have significant credibility in any quarter of the country. If it's an exoneration of Trump, people are going to believe it's because Mueller was a Republican and he was always friends with...
I want to cut this off and move it to the next logical place, okay? Because obviously we have a different of opinion here and it'll be played out in the campaigns of 2018, okay? Do you believe, to our Democrats, do you believe that the impeachment of the president is an important part of the message you as a party wanted to deliver people in 2018 so that your candidates for Congress are running because if they get elected, Donald Trump is going to get impeached? Is that a positive thing? Because, I mean, you've led the resistance. You've got a whole year of churning up the ground. Many of your constituents are saying, okay, what do we do next? And you've got members of the Senate and House saying, let's impeach the guy.
And
as political operatives, is that a good idea, Dan? Is that a winning strategy?
I think he walked in with impeachable offenses against the Emoluments Clause, collecting payments from foreign governments for
his
global...
Is it a winning strategy to win control of the House and Senate? That's my question.
I think it is, just on a straight-up politics, it's a distraction. I think the blue wave is a blue tsunami. And I think the sort of establishment Democrats that are like, hey, tamp it down, which is what they're doing, I think they're right on the straight-up political strategy because it, I think, confuses the message that most people are interested in.
We have an establishment Democrat here.
Yeah, right.
I will say you're a Bernie Sanders Democrat.
I will say that
your question, is it a winning – it depends on the audience you're talking to. Every day that Donald Trump has his phone in his hand is a great day for Democrats. You have a president who defended Nazis in Charlottesville. We got a lot to run on. We have a laundry list of stuff to talk about. His offenses against women, not supporting the DREAM Act, the Muslim ban, this tax bill.
The DREAM Act isn't done yet.
Exactly. This tax bill that 35%
Democrats didn't do it when they had control.
65% of Americans did not support this tax bill that just passed. It has an approval rating of 35%. So in terms of impeachment, we don't have to talk about impeachment. Okay. We got a whole lot to talk about.
But would you acknowledge, or what Dan said, is that the Democrats that talk about impeachment may be hurting the message for 2018.
Oh, I don't think so. No. Okay.
All of these things, though, Nick, impeachment, all of the things that Mike just rattled off, these are sideshow issues. And I understand it. If I were a Democrat, that's what I would talk about, because you've got Latino unemployment at historic lows. You've got black unemployment at historic lows. You've got the stock market.
Barack Obama called. He said, you're welcome.
You've got stock market. That's so funny. It's interesting that he took 7 years to blame George Bush for the challenges he was having. Barack Obama.
700,000 jobs were lost in the first month.
And then when he steps out of office, he's going to take credit for what? The next 3.5 years of economic growth under Trump, including whatever growth comes out of this tax bill that was signed last week?
If indeed
the
Democrats want to talk about all of these odd things,
more power,
bring
it
on. Yeah. Because the only thing that will matter next November will be whether the tax bill that was passed last week has succeeded. If people are getting way more money in their paychecks,
are they going to know it? Will they know it?
I can't wait
to hear Democrats running on the fact that they voted against a tax bill.
Let me go back to the impeachment thing. Here's the reason why it's not great to be a partisan issue, because that half of the Republican Party that is fully aware that it is unambiguous that Putin is for Trump, that as Trump weakens the West and weakens our institution, that stops authoritarians like him from continuing to be a large
despot. The same
despot.
Trump.
Hold on, let me finish.
The same Trump who defeated Hillary Clinton, who gave uranium to the Russians.
All right, let's pretend on that one. Listen, let's pretend.
Pretending is a good idea.
We have to pause. When we come back, I'm going to let you make your case. Thank you. The Republicans respond to it.
Happy New Year.
I'm Bruce Dumont from coast to coast, border to border, wherever you are. We hope that this is not the first night you've discovered this show. We've been here for 38 years. But again, we hope that it's the first time you're spending New Year's Eve with us. And drive safely. Don't drink too much. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back, and we cannot go through this segment talking about national politics without talking about the influence of the national news media. Mm. So we're going to start with our Republicans. They may have a thing to say about this. Marty Garrity, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put the credibility of the American news media right now, with 10 being terrific?
About a 2. Basically, something like 50% of American voters today think that their taxes are going to go up under the new tax bill, because the media have been hitting every time Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi says something bad about the new tax bill, it's bad for America, and 50% of Americans think their taxes are going up.
They're
going
to go up in many states.
In fact, 5% of Americans will see their taxes rise,
Brookings
and 95% won't.
Okay,
but
so
the media have persuaded them.
I'm going to hear from our other Republican. What grade would you give? We got a 2.
I think that's way too generous. I'd put it somewhere negative. I don't know. It's whatever, 37 below zero. It couldn't be lower.
Let's turn to our Democrats see if they have a different Mike Carbonaggi.
I think it's probably closer to a 7 or 8, but I'm just going to make this point. They're going to say their news is probably an 8 or 9. Fox, my news probably a 2. I'm going to say their news is probably a 2. My news
all
is probably
lacks
an 8. I think we're getting segregated in
our media. The national media are your news. Let's not fool ourselves.
So I think the New York Times, the Washington Post, I think the print, I think we're seeing a resurgence in print being the leaders. That long-form investigative journalism where you're not rushing to get on with a breaking news headline, but you're going to do that three-part story that begins on Sunday, the national print is really taking the lead.
Look at the polls.
I want to get Dan Johnson's.
I think
what grade would you give the national news media?
I think it's rising largely because I don't recall any administration that's been so hostile to the concept of a free press, which is so foundational to a republic.
Do you know of any presidency that has been the subject of the degree of venom from the news media? I mean, literally, I mean, accentuate the negative
venom
every single time.
Inbound or outbound?
It's been quantified.
Inbound
both.
From
both.
I mean, the
both.
Idea of fake news
but
from
the
president,
news media is the politicians are supposed to be partisan. The news media is supposed to be objective. And I'm just saying is that if you looked at all the network news, let's just focus on network
right.
news. And throw in CNN and sure. throw in. Let's take out CNN and let's take out Fox because they cross each other out. So you're looking at the big three network newscasts, and a lot of people still get their news there. I don't think anybody can look at those newscasts for a year and say that the thumb has been on that scale on virtually every single newscast. There is no positive Donald
but don't
Trump
you,
story.
They're reporting what he says and what he does.
No, no.
And then they're saying, can you believe how biased they are?
No, but
they're reporting on what he says. I will say the opinion is passionate. On Fox and on other channels, it's passionate.
Oh,
but on the reporting on the news.
So-called
but,
news.
But it's there's an interpretation of the news. It used to be that if there was a debate over, let's say, the text, okay, you'd hear one side and then you would hear the other side. I don't think you see that anymore.
Yeah, but this is not something that started since January 17. Heritage has been putting out their own analysis of
not
Democratic
Heritage,
plans.
Heritage.
Others,
Heritage.
National Review
ABC,
has been writing.
CBS, NBC.
We've seen these national stories.
I like, in our republic, a free press that challenges authority.
I agree.
When Trump happens to be in authority and has an authoritarian streak... I like.
Dan, they took an 8-year nap.
Press,
yeah.
The media
where
took an 8-year nap
during the Obama administration.
I mean, come on.
Well, look, invent
when
your time machine and let's have that debate now. But all we can talk about is the media today. I don't know why Republicans
your time
don't
machine
think
idea
it is
a great escape
wonderful
for you.
To have an oppositional free press that challenges authority.
No, but that's right. Fine, but they cross the line dramatically
it.
Every day. It's been object. It's not an opinion issue. It's been the number of negative articles that have been written and segments that have been produced about Donald Trump. It's like 20,
yeah,
30 to 1.
Wait,
but you'll say he brings it on. They're just reporting what he says. It's not even remotely objective. And then what other people don't talk about is that, you know, everybody talks about, oh, Donald Trump's polling is so bad. Look at the national media's polling, Bruce. It's in the tank. It's in the cellar. So if everybody's like, oh, it's on the rise, everything is wonderful, you wouldn't see that kind of credibility gap that exists.
But
that's
happened,
why it's below
but
zero.
But what happened, in my view, as a media observer, when the election was over, the country was split. Okay? It was split, and when one side was gnashing their teeth and they were going to organize, and there was going to be a resistance. And one group won the popular vote, and the other group won the Electoral College. And I think from a business sense, I think the big three networks said, okay, we got to choose sides here. We're going to choose the side of the popular vote because there's more people. We're going to choose the side of the popular vote because it's the bigger states. The demographics are more perfect. The demos, they're not a bunch of older, white, rural, conservative, born-again Christians because they don't buy anything anyway. And so literally there was a business decision. When I'm talking about when I'm saying we now, I mean the big three networks.
All right.
The big three networks, Saturday Night Live, all the hosts of all the late night shows, it is 100% anti-Trump. Because they're playing to the base. And and you know who figured that out? Stephen Colbert figured that out.
All of that
he was dying on the vine until he decided, I'm going to jump in. I'm going to be the leader of the
all
resistance
of that,
in late night television.
All of that is true, Bruce. And you have, and not but, and you have innate bias. And you have people who are married, executives from news organizations married to top Democrat operatives.
Let's not forget about the Republican media like Sinclair Broadcasting,
yes.
which is
yes.
freaky how they just are a straight-up propaganda
machine. Can you name
machine.
A Sinclair
not,
station in Chicago?
WGN.
Not yet.
WGN.
On that note, Nick Comm, Marty Garrity.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
We'll be back sometime. Don't go away. Thanks for joining us tonight. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo. All of our fire panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Pat Cotter, Ray Hanania, Hermaine Hartman, Stephanie Hitt, Kitty Kurth, Michael Lotus, and Salim Muakil. Our program tonight coming to my own base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us on New Year's Eve. Wherever you're listening, happy New Year's to you all. And again, our phone lines will not be open tonight because we are taping this broadcast. However, email is always welcome at brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, if you want to join us on the World Wide Web audio and video, beyondthebeltway.com. That's every Sunday night. And if you miss us, again, all past shows can be found there, so you can get caught up if you miss a show on a Sunday night. Thank you very much. We have a panel this evening talking about a variety of things. And I want to talk in this segment, I want to talk about some of the legal issues and the way that legal issues have been sort of presented to the American people this past year. Pat Cotter, you're a former assistant United States attorney from Brooklyn, New York. You were the guy that led the team to get John Gotti, so that's a great feather in your cap. Looking back at 2017, do you think the average American is more aware of how the legal system works, or because of everything that's been going on with special counsels and FBI agents fired and everything else? Are they perhaps more confused how the system works?
I think I'd have to say I think they're probably a little more confused. And the reason is that the legal issues that they've been exposed to this past year are unusual. They're very unusual. This is not the normal legal system of, you know, the local grand jury looking at people who've been arrested by the local police and deciding what to send to trial. This is a very unusual situation because the circumstances are unusual. So I can easily imagine that many Americans are somewhat confused by what's happened in the last year and what they've heard.
Michael Lotus, you are our other attorney on the guest tonight. You are a Republican. What's your take on the understanding of the legal issues that have dominated the news in this year?
The most of these issues have been projected in a politicized fashion, so people are going to get a very politically skewed version of legal-type issues. Second, so that doesn't help with understanding. And the news media, like it does with most issues, tends to get a lot of the details wrong if you're a practitioner. But another thing is with the special counsel, that's a really odd and unusual type of thing. It's not something that comes up that much, and it's getting a huge amount of coverage. And I'm almost afraid that the citizens are going to think that that's sort of the way things usually go. I looked at the letter that authorizing that today. It's very skeletal. It's an extremely broad grant of power to Mueller, and that's not how the system usually works.
Joining us also as a card-carrying Democrat is Kitty Kurth. You are not an attorney. You are a master of political manipulation, and I say that in a positive way. You like to spin things that make all things Democratic or liberal look good. So let me ask you the question. As a spinmeister,
I'm not sure I agree with the premise, but
Have the Democrats been able to use the challenges against the president? Have you been able to use it for political gain?
Well, let me go back a couple steps. We also work with many attorneys, and we've worked on many cases doing crisis communications. And while the attorneys represent our clients in the court of law, we represent them on the courthouse steps. So I actually do know what a motion in limine is, unlike some judicial candidates that we've seen recently.
Zing. Okay. That's okay. But, first shot fired by the Democrats. Go ahead.
I actually agree with Michael that the special counsel is an unusual animal, and it is troubling to me that many of the things that have happened this year that people start to think things are normal, because there's been many things that have happened in politics and in with the law this year are kind of abnormal. As a result, though, we've gotten people, in fact, we're working with one group to start a civics class for adults because people are wanting to know
isn't part of your job, and I'm going to ask Stephanie the same thing, isn't part of your job is, in many cases, to confuse the public, to water things
Absolutely
down, to dilute
not.
Them so that there's a positive view of Democrats.
Absolutely
the Democrats
not.
Are always the paragons
Absolutely
of virtue.
Absolutely not. Absolutely
okay.
not.
Let's ask our Republican
Well,
mother.
I would say that
Let me
this,
ask that same question.
Well, this was the year. Lawyers deal in language. They deal in nuance. And very subtle things in language are very important in the law. And this year, starting back in July when FBI Director Jim Comey made his announcement about Hillary. Is she on the hook? Is she off the hook? So
last
on,
year.
Back and forth.
That was last
or,
year.
Or last year, I'm sorry. Starting with that, what we've seen over this last year is plays on nuance. They basically, politics has muddied the waters of nuance. And legal issues are very specific. And so as a lawyer, we rely very much on our words. But in politics, the media, it's all about muddying it up and making it look like a swamp.
I want to ask Pat a question. Pat, follow up. Looking at the image, the public image of the FBI on January 1st last year to where it is likely to be tomorrow, is the image of the FBI or the FBI, are they one of the big losers of the year in the court of public opinion?
Well, I think they're one of the targets of attacks. I think what's remarkable in that context this year is that it's the first time I remember a president of the United States attacking the Federal Bureau of Investigation, attacking their integrity. And that's very unique. Even in the worst days of Hoover, when there were, as we all know, some very bad abuses by the FBI, we did not have presidents of the United States going publicly with such vicious attacks on the character of the men and women of the FBI.
What's the vicious attack that you see?
The vicious attack, the idea that the FBI would willingly engage in a biased, fake investigation. And that's what he's accused them of. He's accused them of being biased and engaging in their activities in a corrupt manner.
Do you think that Peter Skorich, this is to you, Michael, do you think that Peter Skorich, the FBI agent, and his lady friend, the FBI lawyer, have they handed the Republicans and the Trump supporters on a golden platter or silver platter a reason to challenge whatever Bob Mueller comes down with?
Yeah, and justly so. It looks like we have an individual who's supposed to be a law enforcement person, supposed to be objective, saying, if this person wins the election, we have an insurance policy that's going to let us undo that result. That's something you expect in a third world country. You don't expect that from a law enforcement organization in the United States. And I'd really like to have him come on public and explain what the heck that meant.
Kitty?
I once again agree with Mike. This is twice, but Don't get comfortable.
Don't get used to it.
But what I think is
New Year's Eve.
What was interesting to me is how would other if we examined all of the texts of all of the FBI agents, what would the other agents be saying in their private texts to their girlfriends or to their wives? I think it raises the question of, you know, everybody does have a personal life.
But you're not calling for that.
I'm not calling for that. I'm questioning that. But more importantly, I'm questioning people have a personal phone and have a business phone. Do not put your personal business on your business phone. That's
You've got
just
to pause. I want to hear
anybody.
From Stephanie when we come back. Thank you for joining us tonight. No phone calls. Happy New Year wherever you are. Thanks for joining us tonight. Chicago, we continue on New Year's Eve. Stephanie Hitt, let me ask you, change gears a little bit. Of all the political stories that were near and dear to your heart, what's the most significant story to you that has political legs in 2018?
The most significant one is the sexual harassment claims that ripples not just through Congress, not through just through the media, but through almost every aspect of public life right now. People magazine just last week, a couple weeks ago, had a pictorial of every notable person just in the last few months who's been charged with sexual harassment. And that list, it was almost 100 people on that face. There are names we haven't even heard yet that are being accused. The ripple effect is going to continue all through next year.
Kitty Kurth, one of our Democrats, the same question to you.
The amount of people who have become politically active. For example, Emily's list last year had calls from 900 women wanting to run for office. This year they've had calls from 23,000 women wanting to run for office. The groups like Indivisible and Independent grassroots groups in the 6th congressional district since the November election, there have been 18 independent grassroots groups that have sprung up just in one congressional district. And I think activism on every side of the fence is always a good thing.
Okay. Michael Lotus.
We have to say that the most striking, shocking political event of 2017 was the inauguration of Donald Trump. Something that was laughable to people who were sophisticated a small number of months before. And this guy had clawed his way to the presidency, defeated what two political parties could throw at him, and this is like a boulder dropping in the pond that is going to shake up politics, both parties, everything for as far as we can see into the future.
Are you, follow-up to you, is Donald Trump better than, worse than, or about what you thought he would be? And you were a Trump supporter.
I was a Trump supporter, and I still am a Trump supporter. He has managed to do better than I thought he would be able to do, given that I believe that every significant person and institution in American life is against him.
Pat Cotter, most significant issue, be the political, legal,
yeah,
within your sphere of interest.
I would say the most important legal issue, but obviously it has profound implications for our democracy, is the Flynn plea, because I think it sets up a situation that could very, very easily spin into one of the most profound constitutional crises since the Civil War. I think if the Flynn plea either leads to Flynn implicating people close to or indeed the president, that's one constitutional crisis. If the president takes actions to prevent that from happening by pardoning Flynn, firing Mueller, or some combination thereof, that will set up a different constitutional crisis. So I see it as just the most profound legal event of the last 12 months.
Explain to us, because I think everybody would understand the political ramifications long term if he were to fire Bob Mueller, but explain to us the ramifications if we were to pardon Michael Flynn.
If he pardons Michael Flynn, I believe that the case, both in a legal sense and, frankly, in the public's mind for an obstruction of justice charge being brought in some fashion, either through impeachment or even through a potential criminal prosecution of the president and the people around him, goes up by several degrees. I think it becomes very hard to argue with a straight face that when you pardon somebody who's admitted to federal crimes, that you're not obstructing justice, particularly when the only reason for doing that that anybody would recognize as valid is because you fear what he's going to say about you or people around you. So I think that's a constitutional crisis if it happens. I hope it doesn't happen. I truly do. As a citizen, I hope it doesn't happen. But I think it could.
Your reaction, Michael, to that?
It's an very, very interesting question. The president's pardon power is one of the oldest powers of the executive. The British monarch had it in the Middle Ages, and it's almost limitless. It's plenary. So if the president were to exercise that, and then you were to say as a prosecutor, that's the predicate for a obstruction of justice charge, we've never seen anything like that. So at the minimum, it would be a legally very interesting scenario to play out.
Absolutely.
And I also hope it doesn't happen.
Absolutely, but I would just point out the power to pardon, no one ever envisioned that it would be used to protect the president personally.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Exactly.
That's the problem, because we can all create examples. I mean, if the president ordered somebody to go murder a political opponent and then pardoned him, nobody would say that wouldn't be a proper basis for an impeachment.
Yes.
Right. And I said it would be either – it could come in the form of impeachment as the basis
but
for
to
impeachment
be, to be
or
clear,
obstructive justice.
Impeachment is – but the impeachment's a political process as well. It can be anything Congress deems to be high crimes and
misdemeanors. Right. But the last two impeachments we've had in this country were based on charges of obstruction of justice against Nixon and Clinton. So if he pardons Flynn, then I think he has presented Congress with a choice. Here is an obstruction of justice. What are you going to do about it?
I want to ask Kitty. I want to ask Kitty a follow-up question, and that is a political question right up your alley. Is the impeachment of the president, is that an important message or pledge the Democrats running in 2018 should make? You guys want to take over control of Congress, the House, and the Senate. If you were advising a candidate, would you put the impeachment of the president or calling for the president's impeachment, as many Democrats have now done?
No, I think
would that be an integral part of what you'd put on the brochure for 2018?
Absolutely not. Until there's been a crime, you can't call for impeachment. And if there is indeed
how
an
come
obstruction
Democrats,
of justice,
how come so many Democrats are doing
I don't
it?
Know. I don't know
Bad
those
idea?
Democrats. None that I'm talking about. The Democrats that I'm working with are talking about the economy, education, the environment. Those are issues that are important to Democrats. Working families, health care. You know, as a small business person, having access to health care is a whole lot more, affordable health care is a whole lot more important.
Let me ask you a question.
Than impeaching the president. If he does indeed obstruct justice, if he does indeed pardon Flynn or pardon Manafort, then that's a different question.
Okay.
Just on the politics, is hashtag resist the president a vote getter or a vote loser or not important? Is the kind of, you know, substantive things you're talking about the way to go, or is that going to motivate people?
Both. It's what has happened is the resistance has brought people together to organize, and once they get in the same room, they realize that they all are for the same issues and that they need to talk about what they're for. It's not enough just to be against something. You've got to give people an alternative.
Well, I think, if anything, the election of Donald Trump proved in many ways that voters are tired of the games, the plays, the special prosecutors, the political moves. And at the end of the day, people really care about the economy, how, you know, whatever is happening in Washington is affecting their lives, what their income is like, is they're going to have their job. And they're going to keep voting. So that if there are these things that go on, the special prosecutor alleging obstruction of justice, I think a lot of that is going to go. It's not going to impact the way the average American feels about our president.
I've been a political consultant since 1985, and honestly, Stephanie, every poll you ever take, the three things, and all over the world, we work all over the world, yeah. And really the three things that people care about are the economy / jobs, right. Education for their kids, safety, and whether that's environmental safety or
right.
You know,
personal safety.
Can I push back?
I don't think it's going to impact the support that Trump has. Okay.
I think you're wrong. First of all, the majority of the American people voted against Donald Trump. That's first. Second of all, I think many people in this country recognize that if the president is engaged in illegality, whether it's Bill Clinton or Richard Nixon, it matters. It matters a lot. So I don't think that the people take the special prosecutor's inquiry and put it into the same bucket as they put political fighting between Nancy Pelosi and Paul Ryan. I just don't. I mean, I agree with you. People are tired of that nonsense, but I don't
right.
think looking, that they
that's think. Right.
Quick
Patch
question.
Right one, where it comes
we
in
we
is
got
motivation.
90 seconds to go. Looking ahead to 2018, does a vote on DACA – do you think that's going to be more bipartisan or more of a partisan issue in 2018, Stephanie?
I think it's actually going to be fairly bipartisan. I think what we are seeing with this Republican Congress is a desire to try to find some middle ground. We've also learned that Republicans represent a wide range of issues. There's not just one position on that. So I think that there's going to be more room for Democrats to like what's going on.
What about it?
I hope.
Do you want it to be bipartisan, or is it better? Is it better to be an issue for the Democrats?
No, it's better to get passed. It's better to get positive results for the kids who are trying to stay in the country and go to school and work. We want it passed. We don't care how it passes.
Well, I'm going to make a fairly strong prediction that there's going to be a comprehensive deal on border security and DACA. That's going to be a package that's going to get bipartisan support.
I agree.
Patrick, if it was, think? That would be fascinating.
Is this more important for the Democrats to win, or is it more important them? Is it more important for them to have a great issue to just beat the Republicans to death on the way to 2018?
I think it's more important to do something, but I also think it matters what you do. And I don't think that doing something for the sake of saying, oh, we did something, if it doesn't really address the problem,
exactly.
is really going to get you there. So I would say, yeah. Make a good deal. It's like lawyers. You know, we make deals all the time. But there's good deals and bad deals.
Well, we also make the best deal we can get.
If the DACA people that we're dealing with in this country, if they were safe to stay here, and the price of that was there has to be a wall of some kind, is that a good price to pay our Republicans? Quick response.
I believe so. It's going to be very hard for a Democrat to say they turned down DACA just because they didn't want to do something like enforce
Michael,
the law.
Quick response.
I agree. If we have border security and we have a way to let the people who are here and through no fault of their own stay here, that's great.
Pat?
No, it's extortion. We shouldn't have to build a wall to allow people who were born here and lived here their whole lives.
Tell the Dreamers
stay in
you
the
said no.
I'm
that.
With,
I will.
Ron-
yeah. I will,
I'm with Ronald
with
Reagan. Tear down that wall.
Okay. Kitty Kurth, Pat Cotter, Stephanie Hitt, and Michael Lotus, thanks for being with us on this portion of our show. Don't go away. Back with more guests in a moment. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont Beck, thanks very much for joining us. We continue with another segment of our broadcast. And one of the big stories of 2017 was Charlottesville, Virginia, and the president's reaction to that and all of the issues that surrounded that issue. And so in the last segment, we want to talk, the last couple of segments, I want to talk about race relations and how things have evolved in that field or that area over the year. And Salim Mulwakil, senior editor of In These Times, nice to have you with us. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
You've been a guest on this show for over 20 years now. It's nice to have
over
you.
Over 20 years, yes, sir. Yes.
You still look the same.
Thank you.
Which
thank
means you.
You
looked real old 20 years ago.
Exactly.
I look terrific now. Now, my question to you is, you said and wrote a lot about Charlottesville. What's the significance or what part of that story you think perhaps has been missed by people?
It's been missed. You know, it's been pretty seriously anatomized by many people. So I think that it's been explored pretty thoroughly. I think that really the part that was surprising to me was how many people were involved in that alt-right march. I couldn't believe that crowd with those torches and the things that they were chanting. It was right out of the 30s and flagrantly so. And so I don't think anybody missed that. I don't know if we all grasp the significance of it, but I don't think anybody missed it.
Stephanie Hitt, you went to Charlottesville.
I did. I was born in Charlottesville, and I have a daughter there right now. So
your reaction to what happened there, how all sides reacted to what happened there?
You know, it really upset me and saddened me because it was first of all, it's not what represents Charlottesville or the South generally, and that's what's so disturbing. But really sort of dialing it back a little bit is the racial tensions in this country. I would say the issues most this year have really revolved around two issues, and one is the questions about what do we do with our history and the place of Southern history, and what do we do with people like General Lee? That's a legitimate, real question and real debate to have. And unfortunately, because of bad actors on both sides, we can't have that debate right now. That debate has been tabled. And the other thing is, the other debate that we're having is on the football field as well, and how that represents the debate on race relations and the Black Lives Matter and police brutality. So the way I look at it is what's frustrating is that the issues that we're talking about are very sort of finite issues, in that it's understanding history and it's also trying to understand police brutality. And there it seems to me when we talk about race in this country, there are far more issues that really impact people's lives significantly, like violence, crime, drugs, South Side of Chicago. And that's being overwhelmed by some of this.
Hermaine Hartman joins us, a publisher and founder of Indigo. Nice to have you with us, Hermaine.
Thank you, Bruce.
You've been on this program talking about these issues.
Not as long as Celine, though.
A couple of times this year. But pick up on what Stephanie just said, that there's some real issues out there, and maybe getting at the core of those issues, maybe it's been difficult to do it because of the higher visibility or the violence and the rhetoric on each side.
I think all roads lead to racism in America. I think that's the core. If you talk about economics, you can see racism. If you talk about politics, you can see racism. If you talk about education, you can see racism. If you talk about church, you can see racism. You can see racism in all of that matter. I think with Charlottesville, one of the things that just absolutely surprised me, the black-white did not surprise me. That hatred did not surprise me. I mean, I'm a northerner. I don't know the South. But still, we've got those stereotypes or truisms of the South. So when you go, it's like, okay, what can you do? What can't you do? And all that kind of foolishness. But what surprised me was the Jewish chant that those marchers were saying. That surprised me. I thought that had been eliminated from our society, and it hasn't.
Really?
Yeah, I really did.
Ray Hanania, you're a veteran journalist. Your reaction to this broad issue? You've looked at it from a variety of different ways.
Well, I I'm Arab American, and I feel that I'm in the middle, in between both sides.
Yeah.
I get kicked by everybody. Nobody sees me as being black. Nobody sees me as being white. No matter who looks at me, people who are Christian think I'm Muslim. You know, Muslims think, you know, that I'm Jewish. Arabs have a real tough time in this country, and we are in a little box, and we keep trying to break out, and it's hard. The only thing that's changing now for me is that Donald Trump is so radical in terms of the way he's pushing things that everybody is coming together. All of the black community is coming together. You see the white community coming together. And I'm seeing Arab Americans actually coming together for the first time, coalescing around something. I don't know if that's good or bad for racism in this country, but I agree with Hermine that, you know, racism has defined City Hall. Mm-hmm. Racism has defined politics in Chicago. That was always, you know, we didn't report on it all the time. And we only recently really started to do it. But
one of the stories of the year is that according to some Democrats, some on the left, many in the media, Donald Trump has fanned racism. And his reaction to what happened in Charlottesville wasn't enough. Maybe it would have never been enough. But is there some degree of criticism that you would level at the president for what he said or when he said it, Stephanie?
I think the problem is that people were very upset that he did not come out immediately and condemn the violence that occurred there.
The big thing is he said there were good people on both sides.
Which has borne out to be true. There were groups that were, you know, on both sides stirring up trouble. And so any hesitation that he had is now taken as an affront. And the problem with the Donald Trump thing is I feel like he's just sort of the scapegoat. The racism, the tensions that exist have existed long before Donald Trump was elected president, long before he even campaigned to be president. And that's the problem. I think that there was this feeling when Barack Obama was president that racial relations were going to improve, that the racial issues would become better, that we'd be out on the forefront, that Americans would finally openly deal with these issues. That has not happened.
Did they? Did race relations improve when Barack Obama was president? Hermine is shaking her head no. What do you say, Celine?
No, they didn't improve. One thing that happened is that President Obama's campaign was construed as part of the civil rights movement for a lot of African Americans. It was conflated with the civil rights movement, and so even though he wasn't, mm-hmm. It demobilized the real civil rights movement, and it really stagnated mm-hmm. a lot of folks who looked at his presidency as kind of our arrival. But at the same time, it provoked a lot of animosity in those who were threatened by his by his presidency, and he wasn't ready for that. He wasn't ready for the pushback.
So did Charlottesville, was that in essence a jump start for both of these divergent movements?
No, well, yeah, no, I don't agree that they were. I mean, I don't agree that Trump hit the right chord by saying there were nice folks on both sides. I think that was exactly the wrong tone to strike. You can't make symmetry between Nazism and anti-Nazism. There's no symmetry there, and to make that a symmetrical arrangement, it distorts the moral perspective on all of this. And so I think Trump is distorting the moral perspective and aiding people who have racist tendencies.
Is it possible to be a person, whether you're a Southerner or not, who believes that statues to Civil War heroes at the time, that those deserve a place in the public square? Is that a legitimate debate where differing people can have differing opinions? Or if you believe in Southern heritage, which is that's the umbrella that they use, that if you believe in Southern heritage, aha, you must be a racist.
Well, for African Americans, that's a dicey.
That's what we're trying to figure
out.
It's
very dicey.
That's the real debate. Yeah.
Yeah, because we were enslaved, so it couldn't have been a positive situation. That Southern heritage meant our enslavement.
Here's the solution, though. You can have your Southern statues, but we also need the Harriet Tubman statue. We also need the Frederick Douglass statue. We need some other statues to kind of balance it out. If you go to Washington,
just in the North,
everywhere, you need it everywhere. But in the South, it's an insult because what it really is saying it was taking a pride in slave owners. It's taking a pride in racism. That's the black viewpoint of it. And with the absence of a Harriet Tubman and the absence of a Frederick Douglass and the absence of some of the black heroes, there's no balance to it. There's absolutely no balance. History is history, but I also think it's a distraction. Here we are in 2017. We've got economic problems, we've got violence, we've got this, we've got that, and we are having a public damn conversation on 100 years ago, 150 years ago, on who did what. Really? Can't we talk about something else?
I spent 20 years in the Chicago City Hall press room, and the one thing I learned is that you can be cynical about journalism. I don't believe that Donald Trump is racist. I don't believe that what he said was intended to provoke provoke blacks or to embolden the neo-Nazis. He wasn't supporting the Nazis. He was saying something that was so easily changed and manipulated, I believe, by the media to fit and feed a movement that they could see happening and fuel that. And I think that's the big problem today. Trump isn't really the problem. It's the way we're looking at things. We're not looking at it fairly.
That's right.
We've got a pause. From coast to coast and border to border, thank you very much for spending New Year's Eve with us this evening. More conversation from Chicago in a couple of minutes. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you much for joining us. Before we leave, usually at the end of the show, I rattle off the names of the people that make this program possible. Our television director, Fritz Goldman, our radio producer, Dan Dorfman, our engineer for radio, Sam Greenberg. And I just want to thank them, give them a little more time at the end of this broadcast and at the end of this year. We really cannot do this program without them each and every Sunday night. They're part of our Sunday night family. You don't see them. You don't get a chance to hear from them. They're talking back to me after the show, giving me their feedback. But again, we thank them very much for their longtime service to this program. And again, to our newcomer, Sam Greenberg, we thank you very much as well. With our guests, we've got our last segment. This is the last segment of 2017. One of the defining issues of the whole year, and we thought that maybe it was an issue that was dormant, and then it came back, NFL players kneeling during the national anthem. Mm. Let me ask you, Salim. It started with Colin Kaepernick of the San Francisco 49ers wanting to protest police brutality and the treatment of blacks in the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
It's now about something else, at least in the general understanding. How did that very serious, focused issue that Kaepernick had, how did that get sort of taken away by the news media and everybody else?
Really been taken away now. Now we're talking about Puffy Combs buying the Carolina Panthers.
Yeah, that's right.
And hiring Kaepernick. No, I think really it was completely hijacked. Mm-hmm. Kaepernick's issue was police brutality, which is a serious issue in the African-American community and should be focused on intently. That was his intent. And yet we've been distracted by ancillary issues that are attached to
it. Did Trump do it? Trump
no, no, the, no.
You
no.
don't think Trump was
Trump added a little bit to it, by trying to inflame his base. I think the issue is something that predates and will last beyond Trump.
I don't think his story was told very well. As a black man walking off the field and getting in the car, going home or going to the restaurant, those guys experience the same thing the Joe Blow black man experiences on the corner. And that's the police harassment. That's the police traffic ticket. That's the lady grabbing her purse. I'm scared of you, big black guy, kind of thing. The kneeling got taken out of perspective. Trump added to it because he gave focus to it. He gave rise to it. We in the news media, Trump is manipulative. And Trump is Trump is so manipulating the news media because of what we call news now and what we report. We report every day, two or three times a day, on the Trump tweet. I mean, what could be better for branding than that? Every day there's news on Trump tweeted today, da 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 da. Why are we reporting on that? That's not news.
Is it not news when the President of the United States expresses an opinion?
No, I disagree. I do think it's news. I think Twitter is today's new newspaper. You know, we went from Tribune to USA Today, how they crunched it down. Now we're down to 240. Is it 240 characters?
240.
They decided to expand it. I want to go back to Colin Kaepernick because, I remember when the two African-American athletes during the Olympics stood up and held their fists in the air at a time when it really, to me as a white person, quote unquote, it meant something. To me, as a cynical journalist, I look at Colin and I think, was this just an opportunity by a very wealthy football player whose career had taken kind of a little dump, and he wasn't going anywhere to get himself attention? And I don't think it's wrong to look at it that way. I don't see Colin Kaepernick as the kind of person who experiences the day-to-day racism that other people may experience on the street.
Yeah, but
and that's what I question.
Did you think Dr. Martin Luther King experienced?
But yeah, way back. But we're talking about in the 60s.
Class. He grew up in the middle class. He was insulated
from
that.
But in the 60s.
He became the champion.
In the 60s in Chicago, you had white neighborhoods. You had black neighborhoods. You couldn't
still
cross
got
the street.
White. 2017, you still got white and black neighborhoods.
But Ray, wasn't that movement? You're interpreting what might have been on his mind. But historically speaking, and the way the issue has, again, it may have been hijacked, but it's still there. We're still talking about it.
We're going to
talk about it for a while because sort of the genie is out of the bottle. But my point is he somewhat like Rosa Parks?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's a Rosa Parks moment.
It's
exactly what it is.
It's what he chose to protest in a way.
It's what Rosa Parks chose.
But she didn't choose to protest the flag or the anthem. And I think that's really important to realize.
But that's not what he protested.
But he's kneeling during the national anthem, which is a separate. Are a lot of people out there, many who voted for Trump, who are incredibly patriotic, where the anthem
is
sacred.
If they're patriotic, they should understand the meaning of the anthem.
I understand that, but most people took a lot of people
that
are frustrated.
They
feel like
rather than patriotic.
There is a time and place to have a protest. There are different ways to do it, but this continuous way of during the anthem, not standing for the one thing that should be for all Americans.
The one thing
that's where people
the
felt
one thing that
like
indicates
he stepped on the wrong one.
It's the one thing that indicates our creedal identity as Americans. That is not bowing to the kinds of authority that we have the right to protest what we consider injustice, we have a right.
That's insulting.
That's the creed of
America. Is the right. And that is the right every Sunday night to have a robust discussion of politics from all sides. Salim Uwakil, Hermaine Hartman, Stephanie Hitt, Ray Hanania, thank you for joining us on this portion of our show. I thank you again to Dan Dorfman and Fritz Goldman and Sam Greenberg. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.